Food Today. Science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council. On the 25th through 28th of May 2011, scientists from across the globe met in Istanbul, Turkey for the 18th Annual European Congress on Obesity. Hosted by the European Association for the Study of Obesity and the Turkish Association for the Study of Obesity, the Congress was a lively exchange of new research and a discussion of prevention strategies for the future. UFIC interviewed six key speakers at the conference about the developments in their respective fields of research. One important aspect of obesity research and prevention is the monitoring of obesity rates. The European Childhood Obesity Surveillance Initiative, COSI, from the World Health Organization, WHO, is one program in place since 2007, aiming to obtain standardized data on obesity prevalence in children. Dr. Joanne Breda, Program Manager for Nutrition, Physical Activity and Obesity at WHO, explains its significance.
COSI is very important because it involves a big group of countries from the European region of WHO. It allows us to have information of the prevalence of obesity over the years in school-age children, so children 6 to 9 years old. So we can see the trend in terms of obesity in these countries every 2 years. And it's very important because it's the first time in Europe that you have common methodology, same methods, same tools all over the place.
So far, what can we learn from the data COSI has gathered?
The preliminary data points to 24% of children, so 6 to 9 years old, which are overweight or obese. In most of the countries, we suspect that obesity is not decreasing, on the contrary, is at least stable, and probably it's increasing in the majority of the European region of WHO member states.
Dr. Breda acknowledges that it will take a combination of many changes to tackle childhood obesity.
You really need to tackle the roots of the problem, like some of these social inequalities that also contribute to widening the gap of obesity in Europe, especially in children. So the social issues are very important in this context. We really need to work in a health in all policies context. We involve as many stakeholders as you can. So we really need to involve different sectors. The national plans to counteract obesity, they are very important. So issues like that marketing of food to children, reformulation, food labeling, good conditions for physical activity, they are absolutely critical. So only a combination of all of this is able to give us enough power to solve the problem. What we want to do is to make the projects we have in terms of monitoring and surveillance more sustainable, to scale them up, so in fact to achieve bigger numbers in terms of number of countries involved and number of population affected involved in the project. So very robust and strong projects with very clear objectives and being relevant to most of the European region member states.
Dr. Esther von Slaus, an investigative scientist at the Medical Research Council Epidemiology Unit in Cambridge and researcher at the UK CRC Centre for Diet and Activity Research in Cambridge, has been studying diet and physical activity in youth through a project called SPEEDY. SPEEDY is a collaborative study with the Departments of Health Policy and Practice and Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. The study is supported by a grant from the National Prevention Research Initiative. Dr. von Slaus explains.
SPEEDY stands for Sports Physical Activity and Eating Behaviour Environmental Determinants in Young People, and the main aim of the SPEEDY study is to study the relative influence of individual and collective determinants on children's physical activity and dietary behaviour. So SPEEDY is a study in which we assess 2009 10-year-old children recruited from 92 schools across the county of Norfolk in the UK.
Results from SPEEDY show that children are relatively active, with about two-thirds of children meeting the recommended 60 minutes of physical activity per day. However, for some children, physical activity declines at varying times of year.
We found that this decline is actually largest in the weekends, in girls, in those of higher socioeconomic status, and those with a higher body fat percentage. We've also identified that vigorous physical activity seems to be most associated with the anthropometry outcomes, and that children engage less in vigorous physical activity over the weekend. So we think that actually targeting vigorous physical activity in weekends may be a fruitful strategy to tackle obesity in children.
Dr. Bernard Gutin is Adjunct Professor of Nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Emeritus Professor of Applied Physiology, Teachers College, Columbia University, and Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics and Physiology, Medical College of Georgia. He agrees people need to do more activity.
Over the last 100 years or so, there's been a marked decline in the amount of physical activity that people do. So really, the abnormal state of affairs is what we see as common now in the developed countries. In other words, when we say people should exercise, it's not as if we're asking them to do something unusual. For thousands of years, maybe millions of years, in our evolutionary past, people did a lot of exercise. There were two ways of defining the intensity of activity. So it depends on what kind of setting you're in. If it's a public health recommendation, we say running versus walking. The second way of describing intensity is by the individual. So for a very heavy person who's very unfit, just walking is vigorous. Another way of thinking of it is how you perceive how hard you think the work is. And if it makes you breathe hard and sweat, and you can feel your heart pounding, that's vigorous exercise.
Dr. Gutin notes that the type of exercise seems to matter, particularly for children who need vigorous activity to stay in good health.
If you take a very overweight person or a person who has been sedentary for many years, then walking is sufficient. But if you take a young person, like a child, walking is probably not sufficient. So for, let's say, a child, in order to maintain fitness and prevent getting too fat, it probably is a good idea for them to do activities that involve running. So the general idea is they should run and jump, push and pull, and at a fairly high level where they would get tired in a few minutes. And that would be better. So sometimes we have recommendations that children should walk to school. Well, I think that's a good idea, but walking is not strenuous enough. I think it's important to get to a running level for at least a few minutes a day, which would mean sports like soccer or football or basketball or gymnastics or dancing. Now for adults, as I said, if they have been inactive for a long time, just walking and then maybe progressing to brisk walking, maybe carrying small weights in the hands to increase the amount of effort, and then gradually progressing up to running would be good.
What can we do to help children enjoy more physical activity each day?
From an environmental point of view, if we were to say, what should a school do or what should a community do? They need to arrange the environment in a way that promotes vigorous physical activity. Now, what are some examples of that? So it's possible to improve the physical education, to have enough of it, which is to say at least 30 minutes a day of vigorous activity. Then there's recess time. There should be supervision so they're safe and they're encouraged to go out and play. And then we need to collaborate with recreation departments so you can have enough sports clubs so that many of the children can participate. And then bumping it up to another level, we have national governments deciding how many gymnasiums to build. I think there are all these levels. And then, of course, there are recommendations that are made to the public about what they should do. So families and the children themselves realize what they need to do in order to be healthy.
In addition to physical activity, diet and eating behavior are key elements of weight management. Researchers are looking at the physiological and biological regulation that controls eating behavior. Dr. Graham Finlayson, assistant professor in the Human Appetite Research Unit in the Biopsychology Group of the University of Leeds, describes his research on appetite and food consumption.
Our study is looking at drivers of overconsumption. So we measure food intake very carefully in overweight and obese individuals. So what we did was we had 41 participants who came to our laboratory over a course of 12 weeks, and they were undergoing physical activity intervention, so doing a fixed amount of exercise every day. And we're interested against this background to measure their food intake and also the psychological drivers or predictors of this food intake. So at the beginning, middle and end of the intervention, we were measuring aspects of their appetite.
Dr. Finlayson and his team found insights onto the separate effects of hunger signals and reward signals on appetite.
We found that the appetite aspects or the hunger aspects as well as the reward aspects were independently associated with food intake. And this is interesting to us because it suggests that we're not dealing with just sort of one completely overlapping system, but it's worth to try and dissect different components of appetite and what motivates people to eat.
If both hunger and reward affect eating habits, what does this mean for obesity treatment?
I think this has quite interesting implications in terms of treatment of obesity, or at least the overconsumption aspect or the behavioural aspect of obesity, because it suggests that we can target both hunger-related but also reward-related aspects of the behaviour itself of food intake.
While it's important to understand the regulation of eating behaviour, it's equally important to develop effective counselling strategies to help people change eating habits. Professor Alain Gollet, head of Division of Therapeutical Teaching for Chronic Diseases at the University Hospital of Geneva, explains motivational interviewing, a counselling approach that health professionals can use to help patients make successful lifestyle changes.
Our approach is centred to the patient, his needs, his wish, his resources, his beliefs, and we have to base everything on his wish. And at that time, we have to negotiate. To negotiate, and sometimes it's very small, I would say baby step by baby step. And after that, we have to elicit the motivation to find the inner motivation. At the end of that, we have to search for success.
Motivational interviewing places the incentive and responsibility on the client, allowing them to choose behavior change. Professor Gollet explains the strategies of motivational interviewing.
We use open question, we use reformulation, or we say also actively reflection to be sure that I understand. We also support the patient, we also summarize what he said. And the most important is the part of change talk. Some patients say something positive, I should really use it, and in order to mobilize the change of the patient. I would say the most important is to tune with the patient. That means most of the time the objectives are not the same. So if you have the same objectives and you go by small steps, it's going to be easier for the patient.
Even with approaches such as motivational interviewing, managing obesity in children is a delicate and difficult task. One key for success is clear communication between health professionals, family members, and the children. Dr. Tommy Visser, an epidemiologist from Free Windesheim University in the Netherlands and research coordinator at the Research Centre for Overweight Prevention, has researched ways to improve this communication.
Our study addressed the possibilities to implement guidelines and standard protocols for obesity management. The two main findings were that patients do not feel taken seriously by medical doctors and healthcare professionals, but it is also the other way around, that health professionals do not think that patients are serious. And both statements are not true at all. We have been speaking to patients very motivated to do something about their health, and also these professionals were very much motivated to help the patients. So it's really something that we need to work on to get those two groups together.
How can health professionals improve the management of childhood obesity?
I think what health professionals need to do is think as a patient. They need to understand what the patient is asking for. And that is a very difficult job. It seems easy, but the whole education for health professionals has always been to treat the disease. But it's now time, especially in chronic disease management, to deal with the patient, to get in contact with the patient and really to try to learn the patient and not only the disease.
We have glimpsed just a few out of the many scientific developments presented at the 18th European Congress on Obesity. The Congress covered a wide range of topics, including childhood obesity, and modifiable factors such as diet, physical activity, and behaviour change. The problem of obesity remains unsolved. However, ongoing research and prevention activities make for an encouraging future. Food Today. Science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council.